As our culture changes, we as followers of Jesus face new challenges to our faith. These challenges make following Jesus difficult and risky. In recent years, parents, youth workers, and researchers have been concerned with the fact that many of our kids cave into the challenges, leaving them to walk away from their faith when they leave home and church for college. What can we do to prepare our kids to continue to follow Jesus on campus, especially when they face opposition to Christianity in the classroom, in the dorm, and with their peer group? We'll be talking with Dr. Sean McDowell about these issues and a whole lot more on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Youth Culture Matters. I'm Walt Mueller here at CPYU, the Center for Parent Youth Understanding.
And I'm Jason Sochnick.
Joined once again by Jason Sochnick at...
Yes,
where are you,
me.
Jason? Yeah, that's you at Project 619.
I'm in Spokane, Washington.
You're in Spokane,
yes,
Washington. That's right.
Yeah.
Happy podcast.
And I'm Jason.
You are... I don't even know what to say right now, but I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad we're able to talk again, so...
It's good to be here.
Yeah. Well, this is going to be a fun podcast because we've got Sean McDowell is going to come on to talk to us a little bit later. Sean does work in apologetics. He teaches at Biola University. He's been teaching some high school classes for probably 10 to 15 years. So he's got frontline experience with kids, and he's doing a lot of work now that's very helpful for all of us who are in ministry, whether that's youth workers or parents. So we're looking forward to talking to Sean later.
It'll be a lot of fun. But I do think I need to, before we go further, to allow the listening audience to know that you are looking for a unique way to intro today's episode, this podcast. And so thus my excitement.
An interruption.
An interruption is a great thing.
Yeah, it's a great thing.
Yeah.
So,
we are excited to have Sean on. It will be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, good. And we're going to talk, as we always do, about some of the things that are happening in pop culture. And you know what? There's so much out there. How do you choose? You know, we go looking, you know, and I say, Jason, come up with three trends or three stories. What are three things you're hearing about now that we need to talk about? And I do the same thing. It's hard to whittle it down.
So much. And there's always, it seems like it's on repeat sometimes too.
Oh yeah.
So there's a lot of times as you're cycling through the news.
Yeah.
Many of these trends and issues continue to come up. And
right.
So although the articles are different, the trends and issues remain.
Yeah. And we always try to make it so that it's practical, that it's helpful, that it's timely, and something that people will care about. But we always precede it with things that people don't care about. And that is a question or something from...
That's exactly right.
it's too bad people can't see us here. I mean, someday we're going to... We are working on that, right?
We're working on a live
stream so that people can actually watch in real time while we are recording because it's entertaining.
And I really hope people don't mind me wearing pajamas when we do that because, they can't see now, but,
Okay, let's talk about youth culture. Do people still wear pajamas or pajamas? You say pajamas. I grew up saying pajamas.
How do you say it?
Pajamas.
Pajamas? Yeah.
Pajamas?
Tomato,
right,
tomato.
Real? Okay. All right. You just got affirmation from Chris Wagner.
I know.
Don't get too excited about that.
I'm typically the one that is wrong. Or
you know,
at least I'm told is wrong, and then they go to the internet and find out that I actually am.
Okay,
correct.
So what he does, what Chris will do is he makes these pronouncements, like that's the way it's supposed to be. And for a moment, you want to trust it. You want to believe it. You want to believe that there's authority there. But he does this with, we're going to get into this discussion now, he does this with the name of our county where we live here. We're in Elizabethtown in what county?
Lancaster.
Now you see, this is where there's a problem, because it's not. And Jason, I'm not going to draw you into this because I know you can't say it. Can you say it correctly?
No. Well, I try to.
Lancaster.
So let's. In all fairness, Chris is right. Throughout the West Coast, it would be Lancaster.
Right.
Now, when I come to your neck of the woods, it's always Lancaster. It's Lancaster.
It's Lancaster. Lancaster.
Lancaster.
Now, here's a funny one. You know, Paul Robertson, who's on associate staff with us, and
yeah.
I'll throw him under the bus here because he's probably listening.
And because he hasn't been a guest yet, so.
Well, we'll get him on there. Now we have to get Paul on there.
Now we'll get you on. Yes.
But here's the thing. Paul's up in Toronto. He's Canadian. He's up in Ontario. And we had him come down and MC our banquet one year. This was several years ago. And we probably spent an hour and a half right before the banquet, but several days beforehand, trying to get him to say Lancaster correctly. He cannot do it. I mean, we can have a whole podcast with him sitting in front of a microphone trying to say it, and you will just laugh and laugh and laugh some more. So he does that, Lancaster. But back to the guy who makes his pronouncements.
Yeah, question.
Right. Yeah, what do you got for us today?
All right, here's your question for today. If you could have your 10-year-old body back for one day, how would you spend your day?
If I could have my 10-year-old body back, how would I spend the day?
Now, you're not carrying it around. I'm guessing you're in it, right?
Yep.
You're back in it. It's not like
I got the premise of the
question. I'm going to put it in a chair
I understand that.
In the living room and sit across and just stare at it.
All the questions I tried to of all the questions I try to think of, I do not think of what would I do with my 10-year-old body?
Yeah.
What would you do, Walt?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've never thought of that question, 10-year-old body. I've thought about 9-year-old and 8-year-old, but never 10. What? I do know what I'd do. I think I do know what I'd do.
Yeah, what would it?
Now, my 10-year-old body would have to be in the presence of where my 10-year-old body was when I was 10, growing up in that neighborhood outside of Philadelphia. And I would I would ride my bike all day. I love doing that. I still do that.
Know,
I do that
so,
in my 60-year-old
so
body. But I would go out on my bicycle. It was it was awesome to explore and...
That was the same thing for me.
Yeah.
That was
riding
the first
your bike?
Thing I thought of. Yeah,
really?
Riding my bike.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just remember when I was 10, I just used to love being on my bike or a skateboard, but those were the two things that were just so freeing and so much. Like I remember building ramps. Did you ever build ramps when you were a kid? Like you would take plywood that you really should not be riding a bike up, and then you would stack bricks to try getting a super high jump, but then the plywood would just be this horrible plywood that was sitting on the side of your house for years. So when you would ride up it, it didn't really give you like a really nice angle to jump. It kind of dipped, and then you went up. And so instead of going out, you'd go up really high. But it was the best. I mean, did you ever do that?
We did ramps, but I remember one time, and this is kind of reminiscent of when I talked in a podcast about throwing baseballs up by myself. There was another afternoon when I was by myself on my bike, okay? Now, you're starting to think I have no friends because all my stories go back to when I was by myself. This is when I'd get in trouble. I was just telling the guys before we started to record here about going up on my roof about 6-7 years ago in December in shorts and a T-shirt because there was something I wanted to adjust or something up there. I didn't prepare for winter or the long haul. And when I got to the second level, the ladder that I had leaning started to slip down, and it dropped. And so I was up on the roof. Nobody was home. It was December in Pennsylvania, and I had shorts and a T-shirt on. It's always when I'm alone.
How did you get now? Now I've got to ask the follow-up question. How did you get down?
I had my cell phone, and I called Lisa, and I said, "How far are you away from home?" And I think she said 5 minutes, and about 10 minutes later, she showed up. And got up and got the ladder and, had one of those looks on her face that I see all too often. Like, what are you thinking? What are you doing?
You were sitting up there thinking, I wish I had my 10-year-old body so I could jump down from here.
That's right. Well, so here's what I did, all right? So I'm on my bicycle, And instead of building a ramp, we lived next to the church where my dad was a pastor, and there was a big parking lot that was kind of on a hill. So I would head down the hill, and then I would hit a grass hill that probably went up about 8 feet, maybe at about 45 degrees or less. I hit that to try to run up that and go over it. Now, understand, I'm getting a little older here, so I graduated to a larger bike that was probably way too large for me. It was an English racer, and I hit the hill going a good speed, and about halfway up the hill, all the speed diminished down to nothing, and I rolled backwards down the hill, fell off this real high bike, and I wound up having to go to get stitches in my elbow. You know, ran home with blood streaming down, and just, again, alone. I mean, it's always a disaster that would result from this silliness.
So when you said the name of the bike and then you said real high bike, I instantly thought of those bikes with the big, gigantic wheels.
I'm not that old.
But I know you're not that old. But that's where my mind went. So, actually, you know what would be a lot of fun?
You know what? I'm going to tell you something right now. If my 10-year-old self on a bicycle met your 10-year-old self on a bicycle, then I would play what we used to play in my neighborhood, which was called the Ditch Patrol.
Oh, yeah.
It was like...
Well, it's called Ditch'em.
Yeah.
Like that, like... Yeah,
did you play the same way we did? This is the brutality of being a boy growing up with a bicycle. It was like a little gang, and we would choose one person, and we would run them off the road, you know, or into a ditch or into the cinders or wherever it was. It was brutal.
So without getting
game on,
thinking about pop culture.
Yeah,
pop
next
culture,
time you come out here, bring your bike.
Okay, I'll
yeah,
do so.
Yeah,
and my 10-year-old body.
Yeah, we'll go for it.
I was thinking too, why my bike? And I think I was 10. I might have been 9 or 10. But you know, we speak a lot about pop culture, and we think a lot about movies and how movies shape. One of the movies that was incredibly influential when I was younger, that I mimicked in a lot of ways, was this movie called Rad. Do you remember the movie Rad? I love that Chris knows these things. Chris is shaking his head. Yes, Rad. The character in the movie was Crew Jones. I loved this movie. I still to this day love this movie. I have a movie poster of this thing, and it was this whole BMX movie. And in fact, the female actress from Rocky, who was married to Rocky, Tia.
Adrian.
Adrian, yeah. Well, anyway, she's in that movie. I mean, that's the only person that was of notoriety. Anyways, I just remember I would mimic the tricks and all the I loved that movie. So, anyways.
When you started to talk about this just a few minutes ago, did you use the phrase or the term pop culture?
I did.
Yeah, okay. So, and then you mentioned the movie, right? Did you know what the word pop in pop culture is short for?
Popular?
Yeah, it's a popular culture. So, when you make references, please bring in popular references. References that all of us will know about.
I would argue that if you're a true child of the 80s,
nothing
this
that
is
you
a
and
movie.
Chris just know about.
No, well, that's not true.
In fairness, we're also showing your lack of memory because this isn't the first time he's brought up Rad on the podcast.
That is true.
When did he bring it up before?
It's a generational thing.
Yeah, that's his default. That's his go-to. It's a generational thing. Yeah.
All right.
Are we moving on?
We should probably get to some trends and issues in pop culture. By the way, do you know what pop stands for? Well,
popular.
Yeah, that's great.
Oh, you remembered something.
Yeah, so let's keep to some popular topics.
Yeah. Isn't this interesting that the first thing you're going to talk about is how pop culture's become so negative?
I know, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think it's a great segue.
So let's launch. Yeah. Two minute drill. Right. Here we go.
2 minute drills. And let's see how well we do with sticking to 2 minutes, because we're not always that good at that. But that's
15
right.
seconds.
If I'm not
you
always
just
good
wasted,
at it.
Yeah.
It'd be never
yeah,
good.
I know. Now I'm 20 seconds in. You know, we're going to talk about this, I assume, at least I hope, here today on the podcast. But there is a prevailing negativity that's happening within our culture, specifically within pop culture and within many of the movies and music and dialogue that's happening on the news. And there was this great article that pointed to this this past summer, and it was just titled "Summer's Civil War: How Did Pop Culture Get So Negative?" And we'll have a link up. But it prompts a lot of dialogue and thought with what we see happening in our culture. Why are movies like Civil War, which is really a movie about superheroes, then having it out with one another over what is there in the movie, a peace accord? And without sounding like too much of a nerd, I'm not going to go too much into it. But then there are other movies like Suicide Squad and Batman versus Superman, and then just even the dialogue around whether or not those movies were liked, and then Marvel versus DC. But then going further then into the presidential debate, across the board, we're seeing just the way in which we engage issues being much more polarized and being much more negative. And I just want us to be able to stop, pause, and really consider the impact that this is having with the youth and the students that we're working with, because this is having a tremendous impact. And I think that one question that I always ask is, are we mimicking what the culture is doing, or are we adding a different way? As Christians, I really think that we need to utilize these opportunities to point to a different way to have conversations. We may not agree with things that are being said, but I think there's a different way than just making it polarizing. I think that we can actually enter into to some wonderful conversation as Christians, as modeled by Jesus and by many of the characters throughout Scripture that we see modeling this aspect of being able to engage the issues of the time in a way that's honoring to God.
Mm. There's so much arrogance out there. I know what you're saying. And, you know, one of the trends that we talk about here at CPYU is what's been labeled as expressive individualism, where the individual is sovereign, rather than being humble and teachable and only speaking about those things that you know something about. People just blurt. They just speak out. So there's a lot of, a lot of ignorance. And I think you're right, Jason. We need to get away from that. Let me shift gears here a little bit and talk just a little bit. A little bit later, we're going to have Sean McDowell on, and we're going to talk a bit with him about preparing our students for college and having a thriving faith when they're in college. And one of the stories that's come out recently from our friends over at Common Sense Media was written by Carolyn Knorr. She wrote an article on how colleges use kids' social media feeds. I've always been interested in this, you know, as social media becomes more pervasive. Employers, potential employers, and even college admissions officers are now going on to people's Instagram accounts, Facebook pages, whatever social media accounts they're on, and saying, you know, who is this person? What can I learn about this person? And so Caroline Knorr, when she wrote this article, she said, hey, all you college-bound kids, she asked the question, what's the easiest thing you can do to impress prospective schools? Then she answers it. She says, it's not your GPA, and it's not debate team. It's your Facebook, your Twitter, Snapchat, YouTube, and Vine, and any other social media feeds that colleges can see. And yes, they're looking. So what she recommends is that since the main thing that can hurt you is posts that reflect poor judgment, we would say when we talk to kids, we talk about impulsivity and just rants, putting things up there without thinking. You know, stop, think, and process before you hit send, post, or reply. You know, she's saying take your time and think about what you're putting up there. Now, one of the things that we would recommend against is purely creating a social media account like you're constructing a resume and trying to curate yourself and look good. We really believe from a Christian perspective that good actions should not be driven by trying to impress someone else, but good actions should flow from a desire to honor the Lord out of a transformed heart, faithfulness to God. And so youth workers and parents, we need to instruct our kids, teach our kids, train our kids that it's out of the overflow of the heart, as Jesus would say, that the social media accounts speak.
Yeah, and they do. As an employer, I when I'm hiring someone, actually look at some of the social media accounts that are accessible to be able to see what are they posting, what are they saying, what are they sharing, because it does have an impact. It gives you into an insight into the individual, so you have to be able to remember what you put out there, others can see. And speaking of social media, one of the things that I really wonder with regards to TV and the way that we have digested television shows over the last several years, if that's going to change. And one of the reasons I ask that is because NBC Universal is starting to bring TV to Snapchat. And so it's starting to bring many shows. So they're not necessarily doing an entire TV show, but they're taking elements, small clips from movie or from the TV shows and placing them on Snapchat. And I think that this is going to be a growing trend. I think this is going to be a way in which teens and young adults digest media. I've even done it myself when I've looked at information not only on Snapchat, but even on Instagram. It's becoming a place where we can look and watch and get information very quickly. It just really feeds into the way that the culture is set up. And so I think just as Christians, we just need to be aware of how are we getting our information, and then what's the impact that it's having. I think that with something like this, I think there can be a lot of fun, it makes it easier. They did this with the Olympics, and it made it watching an event very easy. But I also really wonder, do we get the complete story? Do we have an opportunity to really know everything that's going on? I think that so much of what the world we live in today is snippets, and I just don't know if that's the best way as Christians for us to digest the information that we have. Mm. One of the best things that I remember learning when I was starting to learn how to read Scripture was, don't just take the verse that you've been given, go and read the context with which the verse was intended to be read. Meaning you have to go and read what's before it and what's after it. And I think the same is also true with the way in which some of these shows are starting to be established.
You know, and Jason, as these new delivery systems are developed, we need to remember that all media exists to deliver a captive audience to people who have something to sell. And, you know, there's a lot of marketing that's behind this. That's what's driving much of this. And as kids spend more and more time engaged with screens, there's an audience. There's a captive audience. And so as parents and youth workers, we need to teach our kids how to navigate the world of marketing and make good decisions Christianly. I'm going to point back to something that I wrote, and I don't think I've done this before, but a blog I wrote back on September 1st, just about a thing called the shame list. It's on my mind, and it's on my mind because it's been a little bit troubling to me, in that it's an example of how we really don't listen to each other, I think. So if you're not familiar with it, and I was thinking about it today because we're going to talk to Sean about college students. We're going to talk about some of the issues that they face. Well, the shame list is actually a list, most of them are Christian colleges and religiously affiliated universities, a list that was put out of these schools by a group called Campus Pride. Now, they're a nonprofit organization that's dedicated to creating a safer college environment for LGBTQ students. And the 2016 shame list actually lists some of the absolute worst campuses for LGBTQ youth. And not surprisingly, my own undergraduate school institution, Geneva College, Christian College in Western Pennsylvania, was on the list. I scrolled down and thought it would be there, and sure enough, there it was. So Shane Windmeyer, who's the executive director of Campus Pride, writes this on the list. He says, "Religion-based bigotry is careless and life-threatening. LGBTQ young people face high rates of harassment and violence, especially our trans youth and LGBTQ youth of color. The schools on this list openly discriminate against LGBTQ youth, and many of these schools have requested or received Title IX exemptions for no other purpose than to discriminate, expel, and ban LGBTQ youth from campus. It is shameful and wrong. Families and young people deserve to know that this list of schools are the worst for LGBTQ youth. They are not loving, welcoming, safe places to live, learn, and grow, and nobody wants to go to a college that openly discriminates against anyone." And I just, there's a lot of concerns that we have here, and this is not commentary from me on the issue as much as it is Sean's words and how all-inclusive they are, because I know a handful of the schools that were listed and represented, and I think his characterization of those schools is a bit unfair. I know that there are Christians out there, you know, the God hates fags folks, who they do not represent Christ and they do not represent me. They're not indicative of me nor where I went to school. And what I'm fearful of is that we are not putting forth a godly approach and engaging in godly ways with people who may think and live differently than we do, or may disagree with us on what we believe to be right and wrong. And I would expand that beyond just this issue to many issues. And what I would hope is that we would be engaging with people who disagree with us. We'll talk with Sean McDowell about this later, in ways that reflect a humble attitude of repentance along with grace, while maintaining a proper perspective on God's order and design for all areas of life, including the gift of sex and sexuality. So just to make people aware of that, I think it really made me think about how we engage with folks and what impression we leave.
Well, and I want to stay here. Instead of going to another article that I would have, we can just use my 2 minutes. But I would really like to come back to that, because I'm glad that you brought up the shame list. I know that we've not been able to highlight blog posts that you've put up or other articles, but I did read that, and I came across a shame list right before you had posted on it. And I think that as Christians, we respond rather than really thinking through our mm-hmm. response. And I really appreciated the way in which the words you used were one of posture. I don't know if we always reflect on the posture that Jesus had when he responded to some of the cultural issues of that time. But yeah, there were moments where he flips the tables and other aspects where we see elements of great emotion coming forth, which is important for us to realize. But I also think there's multiple times where there is a sense of posture that is humbling and grace-filled while not walking away from the truth. And I think that what you wrote in this response is something that we should really all aspire to respond with and to engage, because it's grace-filled, but it's truth-filled. And I think that there's that balance. And this is something we talk about often in this podcast. And I think that we have to be able to think about that, because mm-hmm. our desire is not to hurt or harm. Our desire is to be honest and faithful to the faith, to our relationship in Christ. And we do that as we dive into Scripture. So I'm appreciative that you brought that forward.
Well, you know, one of the things, and let me give my 2 minutes here on this, is that I don't know that I really do a good job at this. This is my desire. I don't think over the course of my life I've done a great job at this, and this is why it's probably on my mind so much. And what I took issue with Shane Windmeyer was the all or nothing nature of his words, which, you know, which would say to me, all Christians are, and then box us all together. And the problem with that is that I realize we do the same thing, probably even more, where we would say, you know, we would lump a group of people and say, you know, all whites are, all blacks are, all Asians are. I mean, and then you start getting these stereotypes and bigotry, and people do that to us as well. We don't like it being done to us, because it's not those generalizations, those characterizations, those stereotypes. They're not, I don't find them to be accurate. And it needs to go the other way too. I can't make those generalizations. And I think, you know, as we talked to Sean today about engaging with people, especially over areas of disagreement and disagreement that are motivated by worldview issues and disagreements that are motivated by, you know, doctrines and spiritual fervor and the way we understand the Scriptures, I think we need to speak first, or not speak first, but listen first before speaking. The Proverbs speaks to that we're foolish if we don't take the time to listen. And so, you know, I want to encourage folks that to not react to these things. You know, and you mentioned some of the difficulties here at the top about, you know, with the election year and some of the vitriol that's being thrown around and the way words are being thrown at each other and characterizations. And look, some of those things are accurate. People have histories and we need to learn from that. But the reality is that it's not always as clean and simple as we think it is. And so we have to take the time to seek to understand before we hope to be understood. And so that's, man, that's just my two cents on this. So I'm glad you responded that way.
Yeah, and this is a great way for us to really just go right into what we're hoping to be able to speak to Sean about, because I think there is a lot of posture here, but there's also a lot of realization that we really need to be able to respond with good theology. We need to be able to respond with a faithfulness to Scripture, and that's a lot of what we're talking about because it's there. A lot of times we don't always acknowledge it, but it is, and I think that would be a lot of fun. So I'm excited for us as we go into this break and then bring Sean into this to be able to.
And you know what, Jason? I just because we just had such a nice conversation there. I take back what I said about my 10-year-old self on my bike meeting your 10-year-old self on your bike.
I'm glad that we're ending this.
We'll just take a ride.
The episode.
I know. We'll just take a ride together. We'll run over some ramps together. That'll be fun. Go get stitches and bleeds. So good, good. Well, when we come back after this break, we're gonna have a great conversation with Sean McDowell. Stick with us. In an effort to help you help the kids you know and love navigate their emerging sexuality to the glory of God, we've launched a sexual integrity initiative here at CPYU. Thanks to a generous grant from a company called DAS, you can access our sexual integrity initiative and a growing number of resources for free by visiting the website at sexualintegrityinitiative.com. Well, welcome back, everybody, to Youth Culture Matters. I'm pretty excited about the conversation we're going to have today. Jason, we've got one of our friends here at CPYU, Sean McDowell, who's joining us from California. Sean is the assistant professor in Christian apologetics at Biola University, and he also is the resident scholar for Summit California. Sean, thanks so much for being a part of this. And I want to ask you, what is Summit California? I know, I think I have a good idea, but go ahead and tell everybody about that.
Well, Walt and Jason, thanks for having me. I've been a fan of what you guys are doing for some time and read it and even retweet some of your material. So thanks for having me back.
You know what? I see that and I appreciate that. That's good. And I hope we've returned the favor well enough for you.
I don't think one time you've returned the... No, I'm just kidding.
That's not true. I know that we have.
You totally have. And you're having me on. So of course you are.
Good.
Summit Ministries is actually a program for students in the area of worldview that's been around about 55 years. It's in Colorado and Tennessee, and they take it from my perspective, it's the single most important and powerful worldview training experience for students that's out there. It's 12 days, and they bring in some of the top speakers in areas of like, how do you think about economics as a Christian? How do we know God exists? How do you think about science and faith? How do you maintain your faith in college? How do you know God's will? Like these big questions, worldview and apologetic, the students are wrestling with. They bring in experts who also can communicate with students in their small groups. It's very relational. And this ministry had a huge impact on my life. So I talked with Jeff Myers, the president, a few summers ago, and I said, can we get one on the West Coast, the Summit? And we've been hosting one at Biola. First year we had about 160, then 170. This past year we had, I think, about 215 students. And the letters we get, Walt, are really just students see it as a game changer for their faith. So that's Summit California.
So, and a game changer in terms of not just, you know, my own spiritual growth and development, but preparing me for life on the university campus. I mean, what age are the students when they come into this?
Well, the age is 16 to 22.
Okay.
So it's either students preparing for the university or those in the university, Christian and public university. And I think a game changer in terms of kids just walking away going, saying a couple things. Number one, wow, I really had no idea we had such good reason to believe Christianity is actually true, whether it's historically the Bible, scientifically the existence of God, the person of Jesus. And then second, walking away saying, man, I had no idea that Christianity applied to all areas of life, including my profession. I mean, we have students come and say, gosh, now I want to go into the arts and I want to think about, you know, being an artist Christianly or film or going to science or going to history. So it's a game changer really in terms of the trajectory of many of students' lives, how they live out their Christian faith.
And that's awesome. That's one of the things here at CPYU we've really pushed, and that is that, you know, every nook and cranny of life, or if you're familiar with Abraham Kuyper, of course, and his, you know, his great commentary on every square inch, you know, Jesus Christ, mine, over every square inch of life, there is no sphere or domain of life that does not come under the lordship of Christ. That's stunning to me that we've done such a poor job of communicating what the Christian faith is about that we actually have a situation where students and adults, when they hear these things, it's like somebody just invented, you know, sliced bread. It's this amazing new thing that they've never heard about before. And I think that's indicative of the fact, too, that, you know, sometimes we just, in our ministries, in our homes, in our understanding of faith, we just limit it to, hey, come to faith, and now you're saved, you're going to go to heaven. There's nothing about the kingdom of God and what it means to live with Christ as Lord of your life in every, you know, nook and cranny of life, whether it's academics or play. Jason and I, we talk a lot with Project 619 about sexuality and that Jesus is the Lord over our sexuality. And it is. It's a game changer. I mean, it really rattles people up. You know, Sean, and by the way, Sean's website is seanmcdowell.org. We'll include a link to that. I know you blog on there, and one of the blogs that I just pulled up today is related to this, because you say, why do kids leave the church? And then your answer is, don't forget bad theology. And what you're talking about here is teaching good theology. Talk a little bit about, you know, what you posted there today, because that's a good message for all of us as parents responsible for the Christian nurture of our kids, and then youth workers as well, in terms of what we teach, what we expect, what we pass on to our kids.
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk recently, number of books written, like You Lost Me by David Kinnaman's Sticky Faith by Kara Powell and Chap Clark, just some great work on why kids are leaving the faith. And there's a lot of reasons why disengage. It can be moral, it can be emotional, it can be relational. And one of the things I point out in this is, in my experience with students, in particular those who have deconverted and left the faith, if I listen to them long enough, there's almost always some bad theology at the heart of it. Now, it could be that this theology is a smokescreen, but it could also be that many people are rejecting a straw man of the faith rather than the faith itself. So I give a couple examples in the blog of a student who was bothered by the issue of hell, and we must have talked 45 minutes or an hour. And I gave every response I could think of that I learned from C.S. Lewis. And when the conversation was done, I reflected on, and it just hit me. I thought, this guy who was in the church never really grasped a biblical view of the nature of man. I mean, if you think human beings are essentially good and we just do a couple bad things, then of course hell is total overkill. But if you read what Jesus says about, you know, sin coming from the heart, you read what Paul says in Romans 3, and we just look at history and have an accurate view of the fallen nature of human beings, then hell can at least begin to make sense. And I tell another story briefly about, I took some students up to visit a mosque, and we interacted with some Muslims, and three girls were formerly Christians and had become Muslims. And as they told their testimony, all three of them just articulated such a poor, underdeveloped, inaccurate view of the incarnation and the Trinity. So they had never been taught how to think Christianly about what it means to really understand the character and the nature of God. So I really think, I mean, this is true. You mentioned the issue of sexuality, Walt. I mean, over and over again, I was listening to this podcast of these people who had deconverted, and they were talking about how they grew up in the faith, and they were all told that sex is bad, and it's harmful, and it's evil, and it's wrong. And I heard that, and part of me chuckled, because that's not my experience, but my heart was broken. My dad would talk about sex is beautiful and it's a gift from God, but God has given us boundaries to protect us and guide us. And to me, as I look at so many people that have left their faith, I think if I had their theology, I would bail on this faith too. So it's just a reminder that we have to teach good, biblical, balanced theology to our kids, or so many will reject a straw man view of the faith and never really understand the theology that we hold so dear.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, before Jason, you ask that question, I just want to make this comment. I mean, I can't imagine being Josh McDowell's kid and not growing up hearing about sex all the time.
You know what, Walt, man, it was like literally all the time at the dinner table, driving in the car. It was like a family joke, but I will tell you this, you know, my dad, nobody's perfect, including my dad, But the older I get, the more thankful I am that my parents allowed me to be comfortable talking about that topic, helped me thinking about it Christianly, and just gave me a balanced view about it. The older I get and have kids, the more grateful I am for that.
So you and your siblings never in the midst of those conversations would put your hands over your ears and try to muffle the sound with, I don't want to hear that. You know, you couldn't help it. It was constant with him, I know.
Absolutely, we did that. There were times where, seriously, like what? Like, I mean, in restaurants, in public, you would stop waiters and go, hey, we're talking about this. What do you think? And we're like, oh my word, Dad. He undoubtedly.
I love that. He would bring people into the conversation. Oh my gosh. Oh,
he would totally. In fact, one of the things he did just to show that he would embarrass us is I must have been 15, so I had my permit, but not my license. And I was there with my wife now. At that time, we were dating, and a couple of my other friends and guys and girls. And we're about to get in the car. My son comes over, and he goes, Dad, why don't you drive home? I'm going to sit in the back and make out with your mom. And I'm like, are you serious? I'm 15. You are killing me on that stuff. So he embarrassed us plenty, no question about it.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that is hilarious. I don't even know where to go from there.
I don't either, but I'm glad you're asking the next question, Jason.
Yeah, I'm glad. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I totally was thinking about something else, and now I want to go in a different direction. But we'll keep it here. I want to go back to something you said earlier with deconverted, because that's not a terminology that I've heard very often, and I want to just come back to it because. There's a process that's involved just in the terminology that you use with deconversion. Because when we say converted, I've converted to Christianity. There was a process. There was thinking. There was engaging, and then ultimately an act. And so when you say deconverted, I've just never really thought about that process. I've just more thought about fleeing or leaving. But deconversion is really much more of a process. I would just love to hear what your thoughts are when you say deconverted.
Yeah, I've actually picked up that language from some people who are describe themselves as former Christians who have left the faith. And there's, interestingly enough, the week before last, I wrote a blog kind of on the new face of atheism, that the face of atheism used to be the Richard Dawkins and the Christopher Hitchens, kind of these compelling and articulate but really angry people who just say religion destroys everything. Now there's a new move of atheism, of people that are kinder, that are gentler, that grew up in the church. And although they think Christianity is false and they have issues with it, they're also kind of grateful for their upbringing and aren't hesitant to say that. So they're kind of doing, for lack of a better term, pastoral ministry for people who grew up in the church and are leaving their faith. Now, I think the reason this is so hard for people is, I mean, look, for a lot of people, I mean, all of us certainly here, our faith is our identity, it's our relationships, it's our community. The idea of leaving something so dear can be painful and hurtful. So I actually have a lot of sympathy and empathy and just compassion for people, for whatever reason, who leave their faith. That's just a humanly painful thing to go through. And honestly, I kind of relate to it because even though my father's Josh McDowell, probably one of the great apologists of the past century, when I was 19, I actually really started reading stuff on the internet and reading atheists and skeptics and was really unsettled in my faith and wasn't sure if I really was convinced that it was true. And it wasn't a head game for me. I remember just laying on my bed thinking, oh my goodness, like if I don't believe this, this changes everything emotionally and relationally. Like I kind of felt some of the pain of that. And I remember telling my dad, we were in Breckenridge, Colorado. I was like, Dad, I want to know the truth, but I'm not sure if I buy this. Really not knowing what he was going to say. And I'll tell you what he said to me. He looked at me and he goes, son, I think that's great. And instantly I thought, did you hear anything that I just said? And he goes, yeah. He goes, I haven't raised you to just believe things because I tell them to. I've raised you to seek after truth. And it sounds like you want to know the truth. If you seek for truth with all your heart, I'm confident you'll find it. And then he said a couple other things. He said, you know, your mom and I will love you no matter what. That's not going to change. And then he said, don't reject the things you've learned growing up, because just to rebel, only reject it if you think it's not true. And I found with a lot of people that deconvert, although intellectual reasons are typically cited as the primary reasons, and sometimes they play a role, more often than not, Jason, there's emotional hurt, there's relational pain, there's moral issues at play, and that deconversion experience, walking away from religion. And frankly, so many times people who deconvert have a bad experience. I mean, one of the things, reasons that people deconvert, and studies show this, is they just didn't find space within the Christian community to raise doubts and ask questions and be okay with that. And I think a lot of people, when they deconvert, a friend I was talking with last week who left his faith, he was a pastor 19 years and became an atheist. He said questions and doubt were discouraged. And that just broke my heart, because in my experience, my parents were like, ask questions, raise doubts, seek after truth. But it's okay to live in this space of doubt and still have belief. So deconversion is just a term that's being increasingly used to describe people who were in the faith and who are walking away for whatever reason. Mm.
You know, you raise a good point there, Sean, with just developmentally, when we talk to parents and youth workers about adolescence and spiritual development, where they're at spiritually and cognitively, they are at a point now where they're thinking for themselves. And so the process, you want them, you know, like your dad, you want your son, you want your son or daughter to make faith their own, to put it to the test and have it be their faith and not the faith of mom and dad. And, you know, like living spiritually vicariously through mom and dad. And sometimes just to keep up appearances too. And I know that happens. Jason and I have talked a lot about shame and, shame-based families and cultures and things like that, where you better toe the line or else. And so we're not talking about heart change there. And that's where I think parents need to understand, let's give room to ask questions. Let's not punish questions or questioning. Let's answer questions or help kids get answers to questions and let them make faith their own. So that's good. I like that.
And the reason that's so important is because if there's any religion that's okay with questions, it's Christianity. Mm. Jesus said, love God with your heart and with your soul and with your mind. I mean, you have in Isaiah, God says, come, let us reason together. You read the book of Acts, the apostles, when they proclaim the gospel, they says, here's all these historical proofs and evidences that you know is true. They would appeal to their hearts and appeal to their moral conscience, but they would also appeal to their minds. Now, that's not to say we have all the answers, but we should invite questions, and we have nothing to be afraid of by tough questions.
Yeah, yeah. You know, something you said earlier, Sean, that I want to go back to is in that blog post on why do kids leave the church, don't forget bad theology. You talked about misunderstanding the nature of man. And, you know, it's so foundational. People don't see it. If you believe that we are fundamentally broken and in need of redemption as opposed to we are fundamentally good and every now and then we do bad things, not only do you not have a need for hell, but, you know, when you take that to its logical conclusion, mm-hmm. why do you need Jesus? You know, why? Because we don't need, if there's nothing wrong with us, we don't need somebody to come and fix us. And I think about, and I just want to encourage youth workers to think about that and look for in pop culture, in even Christian culture, when some of these assumptions, you know, those two sides leak through. Look for what's really there, because everything that's built on those foundations, it's just so divergent, and it just changes. It changes the nature of everything. Duffy Robbins and I have these conversations all the time that probably what we need more than anything else is just a good, brutal doctrine of sin. You know, if it's not, if we don't have that understanding, everything else it crumbles, you know. And so I think that people who push back on whatever you want to call it, human depravity, the sinfulness of humanity, original sin, people who push back on that, I don't know how you can do that and still see your need for the Savior and the blessing of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. So yeah, I just that's good. I like what you said there in that blog. You know, before we take a break, let me ask you about this. What, in answer to this issue, what do you suggest to youth workers? What do you suggest to parents? Have you made, what are some practical suggestions for getting our ducks in a row and starting to teach good theology as opposed to bad theology?
Let me start with parents. I think we can only pass on to kids what we first have ourselves. If we want our kids to have good theology, we have to take the time to develop good theology ourselves. So I heard some discussion at Biola about what books people are reading at Biola, and someone made a comment. They said, what's important is not so much the books people read at Biola, but the books they read 10, 20, 30 years after they leave Biola. Meaning, are you reading good books about theology? Are parents taking the time to read books and develop their worldview? Because most Christian books are frankly fluff, and there's a time and place for that. But Christianity has a deep historic tradition of being a thinking religion. And I'm actually taking some high school students through the 800-page book, Evangelical Theology, by the theologian Michael Byrd. And they love it, and they're challenged by it, and they're motivated to do it. And one of the things he says in there, he says, theology is ultimately about loving God. It's not just about getting right answers. It's not just about studying a doctrine and getting correct truths on a test and moving on. It enables us to understand God's character and who he is, and to love him more deeply and more fully. So parents, I'd invite you, pick up a good theology book, Evangelical Theology by Michael Byrd. You'd have to wade through it. It would take some time. But if your students see you reading a book like that, that shows to them, wow, to my parents, thinking Christianly is important. And then all you do is you highlight things, you circle things, and then in conversation, ask questions to your kids. I think that's the best way to pass on worldview, and studies show this. Conversations over the dinner table, conversations while you're driving in the car, conversations while you're sitting waiting for a movie to start. And they don't have to be these scripted kind of fake conversations. They can just be very natural. I do this with my kids all the time. In fact, my kids push back and will go, Dad, I know what you're doing. I said, that's right, but you've got to participate. Come on. And I'll just ask them questions about, you know, something I'm reading. In fact, this week there was an NBA player, a guy who's trying out for the NBA. He said God told him to leave college and that he was going to make the NBA. So he put himself in the draft and didn't get drafted. So I just asked my kids, I said, where is this theological idea that God speaks in this way? Shouldn't we know what God's will is? How do we know God's will? And we just had a conversation about this. So the quick answer, I guess, is number one, you got to really start developing your own theology as a parent and take loving God with the mind seriously. And second, just look for natural opportunities in the media, in your reading, in the scripture, to have conversations with your kids. And it's amazing what kids will pick up. If you just engage them in those kind of conversations, you can make a significant difference.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting you bring this up and you started with books, because just this morning, I was on a youth ministry-oriented Facebook page. It's all youth workers who are there. And I was just thinking about books, some things I'm reading right now, and I threw this question out. And you know, I'm genuinely curious. I want to know if there's some more things I should be reading that I'm not aware of. But I'm also trying to dip my toe in the water and see what people are reading. I have some suspicions. So I just said, what would you say are some of the books that, in your opinion, youth workers should be reading that most youth workers are not reading? And I threw it in. I said, I was baiting people, all right? And I'll ask you, I mean, it's starting to get a little bit of response. And this is what I'm guessing is going to happen, is what's happening. And I'll if you get this wrong, it doesn't matter. But can you guess what sort of topic that youth workers seem to be reading about? And by the way, it's not Amish fiction, Jason. I know you're going to go down that road. Boy, you talk about fluff. That's scary when I go into a Christian bookstore and I see that. But what I'm seeing is what I suspected. I don't know what you guys think, but what do you think it would be? Youth workers. Just a guess. And if you're wrong, that's fine. I'm not going to reprimand you, but
I don't know. I wish it was issues on gender and sexuality.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not it. That's not
what you choose on economics and how you think about economics and politics as a Christian.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be very timely.
Yeah. Well, Jason, you have a guess?
I don't know.
What it's going to be?
Yeah, like the topic, you know, like the general heading. I know, I'm baiting you guys here. This is totally unfair, but...
You're setting yourself up.
Here's what it is. I'll tell you what it is.
Yeah.
And this is what I expected, because when I asked youth workers this question, we get books on leadership.
Yeah.
They're books on leadership.
That makes sense.
And it's not that there's anything wrong with that, but if that's it exclusively, let's balance it out with, and I think a lot of times what drives the leadership books is a desire for growth, which is exactly what you're addressing here. We want to see our kids grow spiritually. Why aren't we reading those things that will enhance our ability to teach, the content as opposed to the methodology, let's say? And again, I think there needs to be a balance, but it's if it's just leaning all on that one side, then I worry about what we're teaching kids. Because I'm with you on this, Sean, you know, to read theology and to read widely and then topically how theology relates. Jason, you look like you want to say something.
Well, no, I'm just thinking even Summit. Like, Sean, you brought up the issue of Summit, and what I just was contemplating as this conversation is unfolding was just the dynamic of what Summit is doing is it's not teaching good leadership. It's teaching God's way of thinking about all things in our culture, in our world, that then allow for us to become better leaders, because we see that there are many opportunities for us to glorify God, not just in pulpit supply, but in how we think about economics, how we think about social media, how we think about just the world in general, that then reveals God's greatness. And it's not just done through how we posture ourselves, what we do, and how we lead. Those things come about because of the way in which we see God interacting with the world around us. And so I don't know if there's a thought that might...
Yeah, well, it's interesting to ask the question, what is leadership and what is a good leader?
Yeah.
And in a sense, a leader is able to diagnose the problem accurately, show how to solve it, and then motivate people to follow along in that course. So it involves diagnosis, here's the problem, here's how you fix it, and here's how you motivate people with a plan to be a part of fixing it. So leadership books often tend to be, they skip the first one, what really is the deep social, cultural, spiritual issues at play. Here's strategies how to get out in front. Here's strategies how to interact change. Here's strategies how to, you know, do a great program or be a great speaker, all of which are critically important. But theology and worldview and books on culture help us diagnose the problem. In fact, one of the things Michael Bird points out in his book, Evangelical Theology, is theology is always done in a certain cultural setting. It's always done. There's certain core truths, such as the gospel and others, that don't and can't change. But how we explain that, how we teach that, how we make it compelling and relevant to people changes because technology and the culture we live in changes. So I think if their goal, youth pastors and others, is to be a leader, then yes, read those leadership books. Praise the Lord. That's good material.
Yep.
But you better have deep things that help us think theologically, culturally, apologetics, and worldview. Otherwise, our leadership answers won't be as deep and relevant and biblical as they need to be.
Mm. This is good. Sean, before we take a break, I want to ask you one very practical question, and that relates to people tapping into, you know, your work, what you've done. And just tell us a little bit about your website and what folks can find there. Direct us to that place, because I think there's a lot of great stuff there.
Yeah, thanks. My website is seanmcdowell.org, and you'll find a few things. I blog regularly, and it tends to be on youth issues, cultural issues, worldview issues, and apologetics. So those kind of topics, a lot of what you talk about as well, Walt, there's definitely some commonality there. So I blog 2-3 times a week. I also have a blog where I've been blessed with a pretty amazing dad, and I just call it Lessons from My Father. And each week I just ask my dad questions. I did one on leadership. I'm working on the abstinence movement. I've done one on parenting. I've done one on if he was a youth minister today, and I just trying to gather as much wisdom as I can from him. That's kind of a side blog I have. I do a video blog. I just released one this morning, literally a 2-minute video on a pressing question I get from students. And one was, is there any evidence that angels and demons are real? So I give a 2-minute quick response. And a lot of parents and youth pastors and Christian school teachers have used these to just show their students and kind of spur on conversation. So there's a video blog there. I'm also on Twitter. I know a lot of people have different philosophies on Twitter. Mine is, I'll put funny stuff on there that my kids say, but really I try to just use it to be a resource for people. Every day I spend time getting online. I look for good articles, hence I retweet some of your stuff. Good articles for parents, for youth pastors on worldview, apologetics, culture, that somebody can spend all the time reading these different publications and just come to my Twitter feed if they're looking for resources on where culture is at and how to respond. Hopefully they would find that helpful. And then there's just a bunch of other videos and talks that I've given and some resources. There's some different books that I've written and co-written and edited there, a ton of which, again, are for parents, youth workers, and students. So I think you'll find a plethora of information, to use a word from the Three Amigos, on SeanMcDowell.org.
That's good. It is a great resource, and we'll include a link to that. Well, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to focus in a little more, center our conversation a little more with Sean. And I've got a question for him about apologetics. He's spending his life engaged with that. And a lot of people say, do we really need to do that? Does it work? You know, does that engage with people? So I want to ask about that quickly. But then we're going to look at sending our college students or our students off to college when they graduate from high school and move to college. What does it mean to prepare yourself for college and the ability to stand strong in your faith? So we'll be back with Sean McDowell right after this break. Here at the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, we want to help you stay up to date on today's youth culture. One of the tools we've developed to keep you current is our weekly Youth Culture E-Update. Delivered to you by email, our Youth Culture E-Update comes to you in a format that allows you to easily scroll through and quickly choose those stories and resources that will be most helpful to you in your particular setting. To sign up for this free resource, go to our website at cpyu.org, scroll down to the bottom of the page, and enter your email address in the tab marked E-Update Sign Up. It's that simple.
Welcome back to Youth Culture Matters. We're here with Sean McDowell, and we're having a conversation around faith and apologetics. And I know, Walt, you had several questions there at the end. I think that we tried wrapping up that first session maybe 3 times, but that's okay.
I didn't tell the truth, did I? I didn't tell the truth. I kept saying more question.
No,
and then,
but it's okay. We still care for you and love you. Would like to see, though, if you have another question.
Because... I do.
Oh, okay, surprising. All right, let's hear from you what that question might be.
Well, Sean, I know through Summit and then also in your classes you're teaching now with high school students still at the Christian school out there, and then also at Biola you're teaching apologetics. I mean, that's a big part of what you do. I've read a lot of what you've written, and you know, and again, that was central to your dad's life in ministry, still is. And I'm wondering, you know, it seems as time has passed and culture has changed, I've heard, and it hasn't come from me because I still believe there's a place for it, but I want to hear how you answer critics who say, you know, rational apologetics. That's passé. We're beyond that. We're beyond modernism. We're now in this postmodern world. There are other ways to build a case for the faith, if even they say that. You know, how do you answer critics who would say, Sean, you're wasting your time?
I think what's ironic is some of those critics really started late 90s and early 2000s. And Lee Strobel tells a story that when he was writing his book, Case for Christ, which just came out with an updated version, he was told by a leading theologian who he interviewed, who I won't even mention here, that we live in postmodern times and apologetics aren't relevant anymore. He goes home to his wife and is like, man, this book's going to fail. No one's going to read it. I'm wasting my time. And Lee personally told me, he goes, I have heard more stories and gotten more letters from young people, college students and younger, come into Christ through Case for Christ than any other book. So I think it's just a narrative that people have bought into a certain postmodern mindset, and certainly there's certain postmodern elements in our culture, no doubt about it. But one response is just to say that apologetics works. And I also think, second, I actually think it's a really dangerous narrative to say apologetics is not important anymore. And here's why. At the very moment people started saying this, in the late 90s, early 2000s especially, that's when the new atheists launched their attack on the church using science, history, and philosophy. And it's as if within the church people are saying, let's lay down some of our most potent and powerful weapons. And I'm not using the weapons. I realize the baggage that comes with that. I'm just using the term to make the point of defending the faith. Let's willingly lay this down. I think it's a terribly misguided direction for people to make. And in my ministry, look, when I speak and I travel and I just open it up for questions and I work with students, I mean, 5, 10, 20 minutes into it, there's always some apologetic kind of question. It always comes up about hell, about faith and science, about how Jesus can be the only way. How can I trust the Bible? Contradictions in the Bible. I mean, if you work with students, inevitably apologetic questions come up. Now, I would say this. I do think a lot of people that are raised in this objection, Walt, are making a fair point that if apologetics is just this rationalistic, purely use the mind and then you can force somebody to convert, well, then I don't want anything to do with that kind of apologetics either. In my experience, a lot of people who write off apologetics have a bad experience of somebody who used apologetics as a power play, who was ungracious, who just overly rationalistic kind of approach. Well, that's not biblical apologetics. Biblical apologetics involves relationship, it involves story, it involves emotions, but it also involves the mind and making a case for the faith. Jesus was an apologist. Read John 5 through 8. Paul was certainly an apologist. Some of the earliest church fathers were called apologists, such as Justin Martyr. It has been a staple of the Christian faith since its inception. And I would actually say now that kids have mobile phones in their hands and are challenged with more questions just one click away, apologetics is as important or more important than it's ever been. And if I can make one last point, here's what we're seeing happening. We're actually seeing the kinds of questions that people used to ask on the university campus filter down into high school, filter into junior high, and filter even earlier because some of the conversation has been elevated online. I had a 14-year-old kid ask me a while ago about the ontological argument for the existence of God. Blew me away. You wouldn't have been asked that a decade or two ago because no kid would have heard of it. They had no access to it. So the kinds of questions are getting more sophisticated and they're getting more younger. I actually think, and maybe I'll get some criticism for this, I think we are shirking our duty as parents, teachers, and youth pastors if we don't make apologetics at least one component of our ministry. I think we're letting kids down.
So I what I hear in this too, with what you're saying, is that there's actually an opportunity here for us to see a generation of youth and young adults that have a stronger faith because of the questions they're asking at a younger and younger age, if we create an environment with really good theology, with apologetics at the center or as a component. I mean, is that a fair assessment? I hear you talking about the questions that are being brought up and then our responses.
So here's the reality. I taught full-time 10 years at a Christian school. And it's not like my students were walking around at the forefront of their mind asking, how do I solve the problem of evil as it was raised in Batman versus Superman? They're not asking, how do I make sense of the Trinity in light of Muslim challenges? That's not the first thought on their mind. But I do think when kids go through some emotional kind of crisis or hurt, when they go away to college, when they get challenged by a friend, when they surf online, when something happens, all of a sudden it triggers and their interest is gauged in a new way. So part of our job is to find ways to make apologetics and theology and biblical truth interesting and relevant to students. Because we're made in the image of God, we will always use our minds. We will always reason. So I don't want to give the impression that kids are walking around just saying, give me apologetics, give me theology, because that's, as a whole, that's not necessarily true. But when we build a relationship, but when we show them how important it is and how theology is all over culture and how apologetic and worldview is all over the world we live in, then I see students emerging and showing interest and responding with just a sense of enthusiasm, hence the kind of response that we get at Summit.
Mm. Hey, Sean, you know, this is great. And a couple of things you just said made me think of this. I'm reading a book right now, which I don't know if either of you guys have looked at this or seen it.
Is it on leadership, Wallace?
No, it's not on leadership. It's called – that's good. I like that. Just play along. Oz Guinness has written a brand new book called Impossible People. I don't know if either of you guys have seen that. I love everything Oz writes. I think he has a real ability to sense and discern, you know, the wisdom that comes to see culture through a biblical world and life view. So he made a statement. He says, we're not yet in America in a non-Christian time. We're still in a post-Christian era. And many people who fought the culture wars lament that a lot. You know, like, oh, well, you know, woe is us. I mean, it's lost. It's, well, I know you would agree with me that this brings wonderful new opportunities. How are you seeing that? Opportunities for the faith, for discussions with young people about faith. Do you see our post-Christian times or moving towards, as Guinness says, a non-Christian time, as being a time of tremendous opportunity and growth for the church?
I'm glad to hear you phrase it this way. Well, last June in 2015 was the Obergefell Hodges ruling on same-sex marriage. And I had written a book the year before on same-sex marriage. So the very day that that ruling came out in June, I released a two-minute video. I forget the title, like my response to the same-sex marriage ruling or something like that. And one of the first things I said is I said, first, realize this hasn't caught God by surprise.
Right.
He's not sitting back going, oh, man, plan A didn't work. I better come up with plan B. Like, God is sovereign, and the church has seen much greater challenges than this, including the church in the East right now. And the second I said, instead of having a doomsday approach, instead of woe is me, instead of marshaling our efforts to fight a culture war more deeply than ever, maybe this is a chance for the church to really be the church. Maybe this is a time to get beyond some of the rhetoric of the past and ask, how do we respond Christianly where we can't compromise biblically what marriage really is? But how are we gracious? How are we kind? In fact, I think it's an opportunity because the narrative is increasingly becoming that if you are a Christian and you hold the biblical viewpoint, you're bigoted, you're hateful, you're homophobic, and as one activist called me, Talibanic, just for holding that view. And yet I found it when I step out in relationship, and I've gotten to know some people who are gay activists. I have friends who are atheists, friends who are Mormons. And when you step outside and just build a loving, kind relationship, not just to convert somebody, obviously with the hopes that somebody would be converted, but just to love them as human beings, I think there's a real receptiveness to that in our culture. Mm-hmm. Because I think right now we live in such an argument culture. I mean, you watch television, that's how you get ratings, is you shock and you insult. And we can see this in the presidential campaign, obviously, right now. But Jesus talks a lot about kindness and a lot of words being seasoned with salt, he says in Colossians 4:6. So that's why I put the book I wrote, A New Kind of Apologist, is all about saying we cannot compromise certain truths. We have to be faithful to the message of Jesus and the saints, but we have to be gracious. We have to be kind. We have to reach out in relationship and really start being the kind of disciples that I think Jesus has always called us to be. So I'm with you 100%. Yes, there might be some pain to come governmentally and legally speaking for Christians. I do think there's genuine concern in terms of certain religious freedom. We just had a bill in California threatening every single Christian school, university, to operate according to its principles. So there are some issues at play here, but our response needs to be characterized by kindness, by graciousness and by the love of Christ, rather than this battle trying to defeat the other side, Jesus was willing to die. And I think that's a model that we now can better play out than maybe at other times in at least American and Western culture's history.
So let's shift gears here and turn around to what I had hoped we were originally going to talk about, but this has all been good. But this article in Salvo, Salvo Magazine, which we'll include a link to, you wrote an article on college prep and how to help students stand strong for their faith in college. The kinds of things we've been talking about here are the kinds of issues that kids are going to encounter. They're not, again, they're younger than we are. They don't have the years of banter back and forth and thinking about these things that we have. Some of them are very wise, of course, but I think over time we've developed some wisdom and some chops on some of these things. Students many times go into this landscape rather blindly, and so you've offered some suggestions here about this. What are just leave us with some suggestions that you've communicated in the article about how to help students stay strong in college.
Well, one thing is for students to realize that when they get to the university campus, the kind of challenges to their faith are going to be moral challenges, probably unlike they've seen. There's going to be intellectual challenges. I mean, studies show that most university professors are far more to the left theologically when it comes to believing in God and politically, probably, than a lot of Christian students. So there'll be intellectual challenges. There'll be social challenges. You'll want to fit in. You'll want to make friends. You're also away from home, where the comfort, and that's why a lot of students can fall into depression when they get on the university campus, is so many things have changed in their life. And also spiritual changes. The environment is radically different. You don't have your parents and your church and other kind of external factors around you. So just realize you're going into a period of substantial change and in sometimes turmoil for students. So what can students do? One, I think Daniel's an amazing model in the Bible. Daniel is kind of in a similar circumstance in Daniel chapter 1. He's in Babylon, and he's being trained up with his three buddies to serve King Nebuchadnezzar. And he's asked to compromise on some of the foods that he would eat. And it's interesting. Daniel in 1:8, it says, Daniel determined in his heart not to defile himself. Determined is past tense, meaning Daniel came into the situation with every incentive to be popular with the king, probably to get the ladies, to have the best food, but he had already made a decision he was not going to defile himself. So I think students need to dig deep before they go in the university and ask themselves, what's my motivation for this? Do I want to stand strong? Do I want to honor the Lord? Do I want to grow spiritually and emotionally and relationally? That's the place to begin. And when you get on campus, a few things that students, you know, I talk about in the article is just finding good Christian friends. Of course, you should have non-Christian friends, but find some good Christian friends who encourage you. You can pray with them, study the Bible together, confess your sins with one another. Building Christian friends is huge. Another one is you've got to find a Christian ministry on campus. Organizations like Crew, organizations like Navigators. You've got to get plugged in. You can't do it alone. And then another thing, I'll give a couple more things, is find Christian professors on campus. Now, they may be in your department. They may not be. First, check in your department. If not, look outside and find the Christian professors. I guarantee you almost any Christian professor on a non-Christian campus, public or private, would be thrilled to help you as a student out. If you come to them and just say, I've got questions, I'm struggling, how do I do this? Go meet them in their office hours. Take them out for coffee or lunch. Build those relationships with Christian professors, and they will know how to help you through this. And then my last advice for students is find out before you take a class a little bit about a professor. If this professor is known for being antagonistic against Christians, and some are, you might want to know that going in. Also, if you're going to take a class on neuroscience, maybe get a good book like The Soul by J.P. Moreland, not so you can be in class and debate your professor, but so you can ask good questions, so you can see the Christian perspective on it. If you're taking a class on biological evolution, think about getting a good book on intelligent design or creationism, so at least you can understand the issues and the questions, so you can get more out of the class for one, but also just know the good questions to ask. So those are a few things that I've seen when students really do those kinds of things, relationship with other Christians, get involved in Christian ministry, find Christian professors, read an extra book or two for classes, come in prepared. Students can shine on the Christian campus and not only survive, but thrive in their Christian faith. Mm.
Mm. This is good. So I love this.
Yeah, this is. Well, you're talking about a game plan, really, for a lot of students. I think that so often we try to do rites of passages or other things in the church when those do occur, but we don't necessarily do a lot of prep with regards to creating a game plan. And what you're talking about, it sounds like, is a game plan. Like you were sharing with Daniel, determined. Well, he was set what he was going to do before he ever set in into that situation. So what I'm curious about then is what might a youth worker or parent do, because something else you brought up in this article is not to sever ties with home. And so I'm curious, one, what a youth worker or parent can do to help the student come up with these game plans prior to even leaving for school. And then I'm also wondering, two, what the student can do once they're there to continue conversations back at home.
Here's one thing both parents and youth workers can do. Find students you know, and in particular those that your students or your kids would know, invite them over who are on the college campus, and invite them either to your youth group or the classroom or over for dinner, and just have a conversation with them about their life, very natural. I do this with students all the time. My former students who go to the university, I tell them, when you're back in town, let's get coffee or come over for dinner. And I just ask them, what are your classes like? Have you met Christian friends? Have you met Christian professors? And they start to see, wow, here's a kid who's a good model. I can do this. Here's ways they stand for their faith. Now the kids who bail on their faith and go the other direction, I'll go meet them for coffee. I don't know that I will use them as a model with my kids, although I'd probably invite them over and let them see a kid who's struggling too. I would be happy to do that. But I'm saying, just think through particular kids you know who've gone to the college campus, have them over for dinner and just talk with them about their experience, and your students will see somebody as a model that they can emulate. The other thing is to just sit down in a non-preachy way and just say, hey, this is a huge life change. Can I share some things with you from my life, things I did well and maybe some mistakes that I made? And you're grown up, you're 18, 19 years old. I can't parent you in the same way, I realize that. But can I offer you some thoughts lovingly to help you be the best you can be in college? And if that relationship is there, I think most kids would be willing to listen and think through. They could take this article, they can find it online or on my website or at Salvo, and write these specific things down. In fact, you could even get on with your son or daughter and say, if say they're going to UCLA, let's do a search and find out who the crew or navigator ministers are. Let's email them and let's get in contact before this begins. I mean, there's some proactive things you can really do. And you got to be careful. You don't want to step on the toes of your kids and become this helicopter babying parent. But you're absolutely right, Jason. Nobody goes to college and just accidentally stands bold for their faith and comes out the other end a disciple of Christ who knows their worldview, unless they have some ideas coming into it. So if you build that relationship, sit down with your kid and be strategic, I think you'd be amazed at how many kids will listen and start thinking some of these issues through.
Mm. This is good. I love this conversation, and we are going to include links to everything we've talked about so far, including Sean's websites, seanmcdowell.org, and then this article from Salvo Magazine. But as we finish up and turn the corner here, we always ask about resources, and I love the way Jason talked about, you know, going into this with a game plan. We talked earlier about the importance of reading, but reading not fluffy stuff or frothy stuff, but good stuff. Sean, can you give us a handful of titles that, let's say, why don't you give me a couple, first a couple for youth workers. If you could get youth workers to read a couple of books, here's what they are. And don't be afraid to include yours, okay, because I know you've written. And then also a couple for parents. So give us some ideas on some good reading. And this doesn't have to be the stuff at your top of your list, but what you're thinking about right now in light of what we've talked about today.
Yeah, I would say for youth workers, two books. Number one, Nancy Piercy's book, Total Truth.
Good
book. It's a big book. It's a good size book. I read it twice, almost three times. And she gives the macro kind of cultural worldview perspective of what's taking place through the lens of passing on the faith to the next generation. Excellent, excellent book. Nancy Piercy, Total Truth. Personally, I just had a book come out called A New Kind of Apologist. And I wrote some of it, but we tackle some of the most pressing issues of our day from a worldview and apologetic perspective. So, for example, how do we think about the race issue as Christians? How do we think about the transgender issue? How do we think about economics as Christians? These are pressing issues. And if a youth worker wants to start building his or her kind of wider worldview and have some ideas to teach students certain things outside of the box and how to actually do apologetics and evangelism today, I think the book A New Kind of Apologist would be really helpful. For parents, you know, the topic of sexuality came up. And honestly, I think my mom and dad together wrote a really helpful, good book. And I think the title is just Straight Talk About Sexuality, something to that effect. I think you can find the link.
We'll find it.
And they just talk about how do you relationally and practically pass on biblical values of relationships and sex to your kids. And I don't even know how many books my dad's written, but I wrote a little forward for that. And I thought he just did a really good practical job on that one that I would commend your listeners.
Good, good. This is excellent. Sean, thank you. We appreciate you. We appreciate your fervor, your passion. We appreciate what you do. Thanks for thinking about these issues and helping us think about them as well. And I know this is not the last time we're going to have you on here, so it's fun to see you again. I know Other people can't see you. We see you, so it's fun to see you. You don't have to answer and tell me if you think it's fun to see me. This could have just ruined your whole day. I don't know, but we're glad you're here and you're chatting with us and so grateful for what you do. Please tell your dad indeed. We said hello, and we're going to continue to let folks know about you and what you're doing. Thanks for the retweets. We'll keep tracking with you, and we're glad you're here. So thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on. You've been a big encouragement to me. I want you to know that. I've subscribed to the podcast and follow a lot of your posts and the updates. You're doing really good work, and I appreciate the balance of truth and cultural issues with relationships and grace. And I think you model that well. So keep it up. That's what we need today. We'll definitely do this again.
Thanks. Thanks so much. Jason, any parting words?
Well, I just share your sentiment with Sean. It's been a really lot of fun having you on here. I think you've added a lot to this podcast, and so we're excited to get it out to the listeners.
Good. Good. Thanks. Well, thanks, everybody, for tuning in, and we'll talk to you again on the next episode of Youth Culture Matters.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.